Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is wonderful to have you company for another episode of the show. Now today we are talking all about how to elevate yourself and how to elevate your team. And we're going to be looking at that elevation from four different vantage points. We're going to be looking at that from the point of view of your intellectual capabilities. How do we learn? How do we grow? How do we continue to level up our skills and abilities ourselves and as a team? We're going to be looking at our spiritual leveling up and capacity there. And really that comes back to how our values are being lived and shared in ourselves, in our personal lives, in our organizations. We're going to be looking at from the quality of our relationships or our emotional point of view in that sense. And then of course, from our physical point of view as well. And my guest today is Robert Glaser, who is the author of several books, many books in fact, but the two books I'm referring to here are called Elevate and Elevate Your Team. Robert's work has been featured in Forbes magazine, Harvard Business Review. He's done TED Talks and many other forms of media. And what I really appreciate about this particular conversation is about building organizational resilience. We know that people are tired at the back end of the pandemic. We know that some people are struggling. And this framework is going to help people get on that path to growth. It's going to help people rediscover that spark that really lights them up and how to move forward. So this particular episode is a really important one for everyone, but particularly if you've been feeling a little bit flat, a little bit jaded, this is going to be like a shot in the arm of adrenaline. It's just going to get you revved up and moving forward. Now, I've also got a bit of news to share with you, and it's something very exciting. We've been working on a bit of a top secret project here at Savvy Dentist for a little while now, and I've always believed that the best ideas for dentistry come from outside of dentistry. I really believe in that not invented here concept, because there's so many things that as dentists we can learn from other industries. And I'm also of the view that traditional practice management tools are probably outdated for today's modern landscape. And that's why I'm so excited to launch the Savvy Dentist magazine. The magazine is something we've been thinking about, dreaming about for years actually, and it's finally come to life. And in that magazine, you're going to have articles and stories and resources from thought leaders across all manner of different industries, whether they're from inside dentistry, but equally outside dentistry. It's going to be a tool that you're going to come back to again and again and again. And we just saw that there was an opportunity to have a magazine exclusively devoted to the business of dentistry. And we wanted to bring that to you. So as you go about building your practice, building your dream lifestyle, then you're going to have a resource that you can refer to again and again and again. And it is going to be the sister publication to the podcast. And we know that there's going to be so much value in there for you. And all you need to do is head across to SavvyDentist.com and register your interest in the magazine. It's totally free. It's going to come in physical copy or digital copy. Whatever suits you is totally fine with us. We can either send it to you on email or send it to you physically. And you're going to have all these articles and resources at your fingertips. It's going to give you a really good dose of knowledge and information, as well as inspiration to take your practice to the next level. So we can't wait to get that into your hands, and we hope you enjoy it very much indeed. So let's get back to the show over the podcast. I'm really looking forward to introducing you to Robert Glaser. Here he is right now. Robert Glaser, thank you so much for joining us here on the Savvy Dentist Podcast. How's things in your neck of the woods?
It's good. It's you're in the future, so you can tell me what's going on there tomorrow.
Well, it's a good day. How's that? It's a good day, and so you can look forward to that tomorrow at your place. And I'm glad that we're having a good day here, and I hope you are too. But Robert, you've published lots of different things in terms of books. You're incredibly well known in terms of your work being featured on Forbes and Harvard, the Harvard Review. You're a Wall Street bestselling author. How did you come to write all these books? What was the issue that you saw? What prompted you to sit down and put pen to paper?
I started writing within our industry of marketing and found that it was, a really effective way for me to communicate and sort of differentiate and rather, establish some thought leadership. And then as we started building our organization and trying to do it a little bit different than the status quo, I started writing about those things too, in culture or otherwise. And actually it was starting a little Friday email around kind of different stories about getting better and improvement, and people started sharing those outside of the company, and that became known as Friday Forward, and it eventually reached over 100,000 people in 60 countries. That's really what kind of propelled my writing and got me into the book side, at least, as I realized there was kind of, you know, an audience and people interested in that sort of stuff.
You write about a lot of topics that I think are relevant to so many people, no matter what business they're in, whether they're in marketing like your business or in dentistry like ours, yeah, or in fact, anything in between. To start with one of your books, which is the book called Elevate. And in that book, you talk a lot about building capacity. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think that that's such an important topic? What is it about capacity that really resonated with you? And you know, how do people go about building capacity into their lives?
Yeah, for me, it was sort of solving a pain point of feeling like I had lived below my potential for a while. And it was really that concept of building capacity and understanding kind of what success, you know, looked like to me and how I wanted to kind of reach that. And so I actually had compiled all the Friday Forwards into a book. And when I shared it around, the feedback I got was, this is really interesting, but people don't really love compilations. So, mm-hmm. You know, what is it in a bunch of agents told me that. And then one agent finally told me, he said, yeah, that's true. But like, what is it? What is it about these emails that have kind of moved people? And so I spent time looking at them and categorizing and how had I made a lot of these changes to my life? And I realized at the end, it was really about this concept of, again, building my own capacity. And when I broke it down in that book, and again, I sort of figured it out. A lot of writing is thinking.
Yes.
When I figured it out, it was really these four interrelated elements of spiritual, intellectual, physical, and emotional capacity, and that they go hand in hand, and they're very tightly connected. And if you kind of improve one, you'll probably continue to find yourself in improving in all of them. And so that was sort of the impetus for the framework, and then rewriting the book Elevate and saying, hey, here's basically the moral of these stories, and here's what these stories were about. They were about stories about building your spiritual, intellectual, physical, or emotional capacity. I'm happy to take a second, explain, you know, each of those if it would be helpful.
Yeah, we really would be. And I will ask you to explain each of those, but what I'm also going to ask you to explain, if that's okay, is the intersection of those points and why all four of those elements come together and what the sum of those parts equals.
Yeah. So imagine a ball, and there's sort of four quadrants of the ball. And if that ball is kind of growing in its quadrants and getting bigger and getting more mass, it's kind of rolling down the hill and it's gaining momentum and it's doing really well. Spiritual capacity is really, for most people, is their core values. What is it that they actually value? What's their North Star? What do they care about? It's not religious. I just tried a bunch of different things and none of them really worked. It really came back to this concept of spiritual. So again, it's about kind of what is it that you value. Then you move on to intellectual capacity. So intellectual capacity is kind of like your personal operating system. So how do you learn, plan, execute with discipline? Like, how do you get better at the things that you're doing so that they require less energy? When you think about when you upgrade an operating system, it should do whatever the task is kind of better, faster, and smarter with less energy. It's not, spiritual capacity is not just about more for doing more. And then we move on to physical capacity. I think we understand that more directly. This is kind of our mental and physical well-being. It's how kind of our body and our minds like holds up as we go on this journey and making sure to take care of it. And then emotional capacity is really the quality of our relationships and how we relate to the things and the people around us. Yes. Has a lot to do with our locus of control. And how we look at things. And so if these were a race car, spiritual capacity would be designing it, intellectual capacity would be building it, physical capacity would be trying it on the test track, and then emotional capacity is, how does that car work when you drive it, you know, on the road with lots of other people driving 200 miles an hour, you know, it's probably going to be a little bit different.
Yeah. Thank you for that overview and for explaining those things. I'm really interested to understand, you know, the ball analogy as well, because if you get this right, obviously, you know, it's a bit like that wheel of life kind of thing that we've all seen, is you want a nice big round wheel that's evenly balanced. I wanted to ask you just about the reality of balance. Is it possible in your experience to actually have these four things in equal portions and equal balance, or do we strategically go in and out of balance at different times around these four areas, or is that undesirable? I'm just curious to understand about the all four of those quadrants created equally. Obviously, they're all important, but are they created equally, or do you focus on one at different points in your life?
Look, I think you need them all firing at the same time for really kind of high sustained performance. Yeah. That may not always be what's important to people, but it's not like you're going to get a perfect scores on each one. Yeah. You know, I think physical capacity for a lot of us is the one that, you know, we tend to, you know, fall out of, and that could be a week or that could be months. But obviously, look, if you have figured out your values, you're humming, moving 100 miles an hour, you do not take care of your physical capacity all, and you have a heart attack, the rest of it's not gonna work so well, right? And that's gonna impact everything. So I think actually spiritual to me is the one you have to spend some time on kind of mostly once and just get right. It doesn't change a lot. It might change over a decade. But to me, if you're gonna build a really nice house, make sure you have a good foundation. And that's the foundation. I think if you had everything else, but not your spiritual capacities sorted out, you're very likely to climb the wrong mountain, get to the top of something and be like, look down and be like, oh, I climbed the wrong mountain. Wow. That was 10 years of my life. Right. So that's what happens when your spiritual capacity out of line. When your intellectual capacity is out of line, you're just making a lot of the same mistakes. You're not reacting to feedback. You're not getting better or smarter. You're kind of like two step forward and one step back, because you're just not doing the basic blocking and tackling things that you need to do and get better and get smarter. Like anyone who's trying to master whatever it is, like, should inherently be getting better at it, right? Yes. Not it gets harder. I explained physical capacity again. You're tired, you're exhausted, you're cranky, you lose track of your values, your discipline goes to crap, you fight with a lot of people, right? So you can see how that undoes it. And then emotional capacity, look, we know these people. Emotional, the other people, they got it all figured out. They just can't get along with anyone or relate with anyone. And so no one wants to help them. And so they're on a very lonely journey, and the people in their lives are detractors, not additions.
Again, there's some really wise words there, and I really appreciate you sharing, you know, what happens when they go wrong. And I guess the follow-up question then is, well, how do you build capacity in each of these areas? And you spoke about the spiritual one, really getting clear about your values and understanding that.
Yeah.
But what about the others? You know, what about intellectual capacity? Is it a case of learning and immersing yourself in that kind of forever learning kind of environment? What does that look like? And same with the others.
I think for individual, if we're talking about, intellectual looks like reading books, taking feedback, taking classes, having discipline, developing a morning routine, you know, learning, you know, developing an evening routine, like having breaks, like figuring out a schedule and a work plan and where you are kind of getting better and doing things in best practices, you know, ways. So goal setting is a big part of that. How do you design the goals and work towards the things you want? Again, imagine someone who's not doing that, who's not learning anything, who has no discipline, who has no routine, who has no best practices. It's just going to look like a hamster wheel.
Let's think about that as an organization. Then what does that look like within a business? We've spoke about that individually, but what about at an organizational level?
Yeah. So if you're trying to build intellectual capacity into a culture, I think it looks a lot about a culture that has learning, tons of focus on learning. It's a culture that has a lot, that really has good feedback. It learned how to give feedback, receive feedback. We don't make the same mistakes here. It's a culture that prioritizes best practices like good working habits and financial literacy. And again, hey, this is a good morning routine. Why do you care if your employees have a good morning routine or they know what a world-class morning routine was? Because there's a lot of data showing that you got a lot more success from people who start their day in a certain way. And there's some really bad ways to start your day. And if your employees are working from home or they're remote or they're showing up in your office and they've started off their day on a really bad note, then, you know, that's kind of going to be on you. So to me, you see a culture where there's learning and there's a focus on like holistic best practices, right? I mean, one of the things is, you know, we teach everyone financial literacy. We want them to understand it in our business. Mm. And we think it's a really good thing for them to understand outside the business. Again, we're looking for better people overall, not better people at doing the specific tasks that they have to do today.
That's really interesting that you talk about teaching everyone financial literacy in your business. And I think that, yeah, I'm reflecting on the work that we do in our business, and yeah, most of our people are financially literate, but that's probably not by design in a sense. It's by, you know, through hiring, maybe there's design in the hiring process. But in terms of education, I think it's a really important thing. In a dental practice, you want your team members to be financially literate. They can take care of, obviously, the business and the expenses of the business, but you want them to be financially successful in their own life. And I think there's some real merit and power in that. What's been the consequence of having your team financially literate in your business? What's that bring to them and to you?
Look, we're a growing business. And so I think what it does is it gets them ready for the next job and the job of tomorrow and what they're going to need to do. And like I said, I've never seen someone who, you know, crawls out of bed an hour late, slams on their alarm, watches the news, get themselves really frustrated, can't balance their budget, you know, is overextended, and then shows up to work and does all and just flips a switch and suddenly is really good with budgets and has a ton of energy and is prioritized. Like, we're the same person kind of, you know, across both contexts. So for me, like, they're just really related.
I think that's amazing, isn't it? Because again, when you think about it, as you quite rightly point out, people don't kind of change necessarily from home to work or work to home. And if we want people to be really competent in their professional life, we have to help them build competence in all of their life.
And maybe not as much, you know, I know your audience, probably they're still more in the office, but imagine, you know, an organization where the people are working from home. Like, it's not really a stretch that then their home behavior and life is fundamentally, you know, different from their work life, right? I mean, it's kind of going to be a lot of the same thing.
And how does that, again, at an organizational level, what are you looking at from a physical and emotional well-being point of view from that capacity there? What's that look like at the organizational level?
Yeah, look, so this is where I say the Hippocratic Oath comes into play. You know, it's first, do no harm.
Yeah.
First, don't have an environment that makes the physical capacity of your people worse. And horrible leaders do this. They stress people out, they exhaust them, they make their mental and physical condition worse. Hmm. But then separately, I think it's really, again, reestablishing those boundaries in work, making sure that people can go home, have a life outside of work, that they're taking vacation, that they come back energized, that they're being encouraged to do things and have the flexibility to, you know, improve their health and wellness in whatever ways that, you know, they want to do. Obviously, the workplace can't dictate that people do that. But what it can do is it can make it really hard for healthy habits.
Yeah.
Right. So you can't tell someone that they should run, but it's a pretty good bet if they're chained to their office desk from 6:30 a.m. till 10 p.m. that they're not getting any exercise that day. But, you know, to do that. And look, people are burnt out. They've had a long couple of years. I just really believe that I think that people do need rest and relaxation and a life and activities outside of work that bring them energy.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think that, again, it's a really thoughtful way of thinking about team and well-being, getting the best out of them, obviously in the work environment, but also setting them up for success outside of that environment as well. And I wanted to talk to you about what that means in terms of culture, because I know, you know, your business has been featured in lots of articles and magazines for having a world-class culture. How did you go about installing this? What's the practical way of going, you know what, I understand these four tenets. I understand that this is going to bring dividends to everyone involved on a personal and professional level. But what are the practical steps of saying, okay, we want to do this with our team, we want to elevate our team, which I know is your most recent book. How do we integrate that same framework on a practical level?
It's what you practice. It's what you talk about. It's what you prioritize. Culture is not what you say. Culture is what you reward in the business, either explicitly or implicitly. So I think, you know, we think about our training and our people around those elements. And hey, you know, if we're doing leadership training, we're going to focus on, you know, these two things. Well, I think the one that most ongoing, you know, is intellectual capacity. We're going to train on how to give feedback and how to receive back. And we're going to do some role play around that. So this is not rocket science. Again, I think the things that you do and where you spend your time, but all culture comes down to what you reward. People are very good at aligning, you know, and religion has showed us this, you know, and you know, the good and the bad, but they align their behavior to the incentives. And the incentives doesn't mean that it's money. Again, that's why it's implicit or explicit. It's what they're rewarded for, what they're told they're doing a good job for, what they see other people being promoted and told a good job for. And that is not those fake words that a lot of places have on the wall. It's what is actually being rewarded. So, you know, if it's core value of be generous and people see that the people who give away their time and stuff get recognized and promoted and otherwise, and that is a quality that is seen as favorable, then they too will lean into that quality. If they see that it's workaholism, then they will lean into that. If they see that it's backstabbing and politics, then they will lean into that. We're all little dogs at the end of the day, right? And you know, we follow the commands and we look for where the cookie is, where the metaphorical or cookie.
Yeah, we're looking for a belly rub, right?
Right, exactly.
And a bit of an attaboy or an attagirl, or exactly
good,
right?
Good girl.
Just with respect to elevating your team, which, as I said, I know is your most recent book, what's been your response or your experience with other businesses beyond your own integrating this? I know you've done this successfully in your own business and in your personal life. What sort of reports are you hearing in terms of how teams are performing, what they're feeling, what they're thinking, what the productivity is like? What's the benefits of doing this across the team?
The world post-pandemic, I mean, there's a couple of benefits, depending on what you want in business, but people are tired. People are kind of exhausted. Growth has almost become a negative word in a lot of organizations. Most organizations right now are not looking to grow. They're kind of playing defense. But look, we're going to get back to growth. But I think growth needs to be something that people are excited about and they're included in. It means, you know, opportunities for them and ways to do better, and not just about the vessel around them growing, but about them kind of, you know, growing with it. So look, you can be or whatever you have, that you can be an Uber driver. There's a whole gig economy these days. If we can't figure out compelling reasons for people to want to be part of our teams or our organizations, then they're just going to go to the freelance world. They'd rather be a mercenary working for themselves than a mercenary working within the organization. And it'll be very hard to build a company with 100 people self-optimizing who don't care about team or shared goals or shared vision at all. Like I think those are going to be like tough. Not that some people won't do it, but it's a tough organization to be in. But yeah, you know, you'll find that they're dentists for rent or hygienists for rent, and they don't want to be part of a team. They just want to go to the highest bidder that day.
Yeah.
I mean, nursing's already, you know, the nurses are so, I mean, at least here, they're so abused and yelled at and stuff after COVID. They're like, look, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to be a traveling nurse and I'll work when I want to and I'll charge a fortune and I'll fill in. But like, I don't know. Why am I going to sit here and take that abuse?
Yeah, 100%. You mentioned something I think that was really interesting, and I'd like to just explore it for a second. It's probably unrelated to the books themselves, but you mentioned how tired everyone is post-pandemic. And obviously, you know, the last few years have seen lots of change, lots of upheaval, I guess a lot of stress and strain. I wanted to talk about building resilience for those challenges, because it seems to me that this framework will build resilience into an individual, it'll build resilience into an organization. But I wanted to talk about how to overcome that tiredness if it's already here. For some people will be experiencing it, maybe others less so. I'm not sure, the individual will have their own experience. But I wanted to talk about that because I've noticed that too. I've noticed that a lot of people are feeling like they want to consolidate rather than grow. I've noticed a lot of people want to, you know, kind of take their foot off the gas a little bit. What are you seeing in that space? And again, how do you work through that is, I guess, the question I'm trying to ask.
Well, again, they don't see anything for them in the growth.
Yeah.
Right? I think if the growth in Curlard's learning and new opportunities and his excitement and his increased responsibility and you know, then it's exciting. But there hasn't been a lot for them in the growth. And you know, we've had, you know, this sort of Silicon Valley kind of steroid growth in infused era. So, you know, that's a little bit different. I think probably here it's been even higher than anywhere else. But that's just what I'm seeing. And I think when growth becomes something that, I mean, imagine a wave and you're surfing on the wave, you're not drowning on the wave, then I think people will be more excited about that growth and feeling like it's something that they're a part of, but this is not happening to them.
Can we change gear for a second? Because I want to just talk about an article that was on your website that I really resonated with. And it's a recent article you published, I think, on the early May. And your article is about failing versus failure. And you use sports metaphors a lot. I love sports metaphors. Anything with a ball, I'm interested.
A lot of people
in.
Hate them, but I actually think they're really relevant in leadership. And even if you don't play sports, they're just the way that it's a team sport, the way people are coached, I tend to think they're instructive. But that's just my opinion.
No, I agree with you 100%. I think you can learn a lot. As you say, even if you're not into sports yourself, you can learn a lot from observing.
Yeah.
But you spoke about a concept I think that is really important, and that is failing versus failure. And then the reason I was prompted to ask this question was just off the back of the tiredness, I've noticed some people almost giving up. And I wanted to talk about, you know, setbacks versus failure. I wanted to talk about the importance of where failure or failing, I should say, where failing fits into success. And what's that look like from your end? What's your thinking on that?
Yeah, look, I think the Great Resignation was a microcosm of this because, as I said, you had three types of people that were seeking new jobs. First of all, you'd see our article saying that 90% of people are looking for new jobs. Well, that, first of all, I don't believe that statistic. If you do, then this is a clear grass is greener problem, right? If everyone believes that working elsewhere is going to make them more happy. So there were three groups of people. One is I realized throughout this that I am doing the wrong thing. I want to be doing something different. I want to live somewhere else. I want to be married to someone else. And like, this was the cosmic kick in the ass for me to make the change. Like, great. More power to you.
Yeah.
Second group. We were in the foxhole the last couple of years, and the people I was in the foxholes with are a-holes, and I don't want to be with them anymore. So I may still want to be a hygienist or a dentist, but I'm going to go find a different practice with people that I respect and I like.
Yep.
Okay. Perfect. Also good.
Yep.
Great. Then there was this big swath of people that were like, the last couple of years were just really hard, and I'm really burnt out. And so going to get a new job is going to fix that. And I think that, and I told people at the time, and I thought that that was just a really bad premise and to just try to run away because it was hard and that it was hard for everyone. And maybe you need a month off, maybe you need something else, but I'm not sure that starting a new job is inherently, you know, not hard. or easy. And also you're being sold by like a salesperson, you know, a recruiter, and you're making a decision in a day. And, you know, sometimes like, that something's different, but you forget what you have. I saw a lot of those people really unhappy with those jobs, not lasting 6 months and kind of moving on. So we can't erase that something was hard and that sometimes you just have to get through it. I think you got to want to be in the trenches that with people you like. You gotta, you know, like the customers, gotta like what you're doing. But I just saw a lot of people that was hard. How do we make that go away? And that's not reality.
No.
Sometimes it's the people that get through that or get to the other side or can, you know, survive, or all these companies that were built during the recession. But to do that, again, you gotta see a purpose, you gotta see a vision, and you got to want to be in the trenches with the people that you're with.
I want to ask where grit comes from as well, because, you know, even, you know, you see those organizations that are actually probably really good organizations. They've got good culture. They've got, you know, values that people actually live by rather than just having them pasted on a wall. You've got good people at the helm who care and are trying to do their best by their team and their customers and all those sorts of things. And yet, you know, undeniably, the last few years has been challenging. Let's just put that out there as a statement for anyone.
Whether you were making freezers for Pfizer and working 24 hours a day and your business revenue grew 500%, that still wasn't, you know, super fun.
No, you might have been rewarded for it, but it was still hard, right?
Exhausting, and
so,
right.
So I want to talk about the role of grit, determination, rolling your sleeves up and kind of just getting through hard things. Because you made a point earlier about when, you know, this is the failing versus failure thing, is that when things get hard, some people go, you know, check out, I'm out of here, I want something easy.
Yeah.
And I want to talk a little bit about how to get through hard things.
I can't fix 2 decades of really flawed parenting, I think, that we had.
Yes.
Which I would call the sort of permissive and overbearing, where it's become, you know, prepare the path for the child, not prepare the child for the path. So we have not let kids fail. We have not, I mean, without a doubt, all the people I saw doing the best during COVID had more, I would say, traumatic childhoods, or probably less privileged childhoods, where things went wrong and it wasn't a new thing for them. And maybe that will be the lasting thing of COVID, is that these people will have that experience. But at the time, you know, it was a new muscle for them. So we have definitely had a societal trend towards, if it's hard, don't do it, jump around it. Like, there's been a whole kind of parenting philosophy that I think has put a lot of people in the workforce with skills that aren't super, has not stressed resilience in a lot. So I can't necessarily fix that. But I think transparency around this stuff and trust and psychological safety, I think when hard, feeling like people are telling you the truth, they're in it together, you're not getting blindsided. I mean, I could tell you a story from early in COVID. So when COVID hit, you know, about a third of our business in 2 weeks was impacted. And we had clients telling us they were going to pay us in 6 months or a year and all kinds of crap. And look, at this point, we had a pretty good 10-year economic run in our economy. So if you were under 32, you really hadn't seen a down market or a recession. Although the people who right before that are still PTSD from it, you know, who had to get try to find jobs in 2008. So it's just so funny how, you know, your memory affects the future. And so we were very open with people. Here's what's going on. Here's what we look at. Here are the inflection points. Here are the decisions. And some of the feedback we got from people was like, why are you traumatizing us? Why are you telling us about all this stuff and what's going on? And we're like, look, this is the information. We feel like it's our duty to make sure everyone knows what's going on and what we're looking at and how we're thinking about this and otherwise. And so I think we kind of over-communicated. Mm. 2 to 3 weeks into this, people's roommates, spouses, everyone started getting laid off left and right. No notice, no discussion, nothing at their company.
Wow.
As at that point that some of those people came back and were like, oh, like, I actually now understand kind of why we were doing this, and I sort of kind of appreciate it. So again, I think one of the most popular Friday Forwards I ever wrote, which also on the website, the Stocktail Paradox, is this notion of kind of remaining steadfast that you're going to get through it and having a clear vision, but being brutally honest about the facts. That's the like winning formula for getting through tough times. If you're super chipper and super positive and you don't tell people the reality and then they get blindsided, you will lose everyone's trust. And if you're just a gloom and doom, you know, person, like, how are you going to get anyone excited? Why are they going to come to work and want to fight through the slog if they feel like there's a cliff on the other side? So, you know, that Stockdale paradox is like, look, be unwavering in the fact that you're going to get through it, have a clear vision, but then be brutally honest about the facts and the reality so that everyone has the same information.
I remember those days of COVID as well, and certainly there was a lot of upheaval. But what was really interesting, I felt, on that, it was the negativity that came. Yes, the facts are the facts are the facts, right? And we've got to tell ourselves the truth around that. But it was interesting to see, and I'm seeing it a bit now actually as well, you know, with interest rates and it's, I'm sure it's the same in the United States, cost of living and inflation and all those sorts of things. I'm noticing that negativity creep into people's mindsets again, and almost using it as a, look, it's not my fault. You know, the economy is terrible, blah, 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 blah. And look, the economy is the economy, the facts are the facts. But I'm also of the view around personal agency being the greatest.
Right, so what do we do about that?
Yeah.
Or what's the, you know,
yeah.
For example, you know, a year or two ago when the inflation started, people were saying, hey, we're just hearing like, if we don't get an 8% raise, inflation's 8%. We're just like, look, here we have long-term contracts with our clients. Like this is the safety part of the business, and this is great. But because of that, we don't have the ability to raise prices on them for another 12 months. So, you know, we're open book. Here are the numbers. Like if we do this, we will be in really like red area from a cash flow and a protection and safety standpoint, right? That's very different than not telling people that. And look, a lot of companies, so when people kind of demanded that we do something, look, we're just not going to do that. And by the way, a year later, we were in a much safer and better position for our employees than some of the firms that were willing to do that or made them these offers, didn't tell them they only had 3 months of cash left,
yeah.
You know, and then kind of, you know, ran out of it. So to me, again, that's bringing people in, kind of telling them the truth and helping them be part of solving those problems so that they feel like some agency around, hey, we need to get better at doing X. Like, do you have any ideas around that? Like our retention's a problem. Like what ideas do we have to improve our retention? So yeah, wherever you can give people agency or a feeling of control, we always say we tell anything to people in the company once we're like clear on it and it's fully baked. I think if it's not fully baked, then sharing it's going to cause more problems than it does, you know, good, then we're not going to do that. But otherwise we're sharing it with people.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And I think, you know, that whole piece about agency, I think is really important. And yeah, you know, my personal view is, you know, going back to the facts being the facts is, you know, we have so much control in our own lives that, as you spoke earlier about the locus of control, we, you know, the people or the things that influence our well-being above and beyond anything else is really ourselves, our attitude, the actions we take, and so on and so forth. Which is why, again, I keep coming back to your framework about building capacity, because if you can build that capacity from all those different perspectives, you know, whether it's the, you know, the spiritual, the intellectual, the physical, the emotional, you're going to be able to have that greater sense of agency to ride through those issues, to be able to come out the other side on top of things. Yes, acknowledging the facts being the facts, but also taking control of the situation yourself. You've spoken a lot about culture. You've spoken a lot about performance. You've spoken a lot about, you know, lots of different
things.
And
you can have a culture of performance too. So,
well, yeah. that's actually where I want to go is you're on the same wavelength. I wanted to talk about instilling that culture of performance, because going back to the sporting metaphor, you know, sports teams train a lot. They you know, practice probably, I don't know, how many more times than they compete.
So, yeah, and more than any business. Yeah. Yeah. And they have a scoreboard and you know what the score is.
Exactly. Yeah. How do you think about the culture of performance in a team, in a business sense? How do you instill that culture? Because I know there's lots of people that think about culture and they kind of see it as something warm and fuzzy, but, you know, at the end of the day, they'll say, you know, I'm here to achieve an outcome, I'm here to achieve a result, which is true as well, but the two don't have to be mutually exclusive. So I wanted to talk about how to combine those two elegantly.
No, and again, it's what you reward, it's what you talk about. And our company has always been, I think, a great place to work for the right person. But again, we're a fast moving agency. Mm. If you don't like fast moving, if you don't like client services, if you don't like digital marketing, you won't like our culture. So, you know, those people like making those decisions and kind of, you know, being able to do that. So, look, we set goals as a company. Those break down to individual goals. We have dashboards. They have red light, green light, yellow light on how we're doing. And it creates accountability on that. So at the same time, we're rooting for everyone, we're supporting them, we're giving them some, you know, coaching. But, you know, if you're a salesperson and every salesperson has $1 million quota and you're at 500 for three quarters and your lights are red, we're going to have a discussion about that. Now, the discussion may be, this is your third sales job you've had and it's really not working out, and maybe you're better off as a business development person or a marketing person, or try to help that person figure out the right choice for them, maybe help them find a new job. But we're not going to let them just keep failing and sort of let down the team and not have the accountability. So to me, it's about leaning into those relationships. A lot of time when someone's not doing well at something, it's because they don't want to be doing it or it's not the right thing for them. Like everyone's a genius at something.
And about finding out what that is, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So just really quickly, because I know this is get very tin tacks and practical and in the weeds a little bit, but there'll be someone driving along there in their car right now listening to this and going, hey, but Jesse, ask him how often he has those conversations. So I wanted to ask you, how often are you having those conversations with the team and checking their scorecards and their dashboards and their metrics? Is that a weekly, monthly, quarterly type of rhythm that you've established in your business? What does that look like? Do you have any suggestions around that?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I have been out of operations for about a couple of years now, but that, you know, that is, we always had those dashboard. We had weekly cadence where we rolled down everything. And then from the leadership meeting, people went to their department meetings and I still, you know, joined those. So whatever you talk about, whatever you socialize. So then the numbers and the outcomes were discussed, you know, fairly often. And if it was red, it had to go on the issue list and it had to be discussed.
Yeah.
And to me, that's how you, that's how you get people focused on something. But they understand that the numbers, because that's about what our goal and where we want to hit and kind of fulfills our vision. You know, it's not just this random mercenary thing. But you can't have, like, when it comes, look, a lot of the opportunities and promotions that come from a growth organization only happen when the organization's growing. You know, people say a lot of things they like sometimes to put together, but, you know, at those points in time where we said, okay, you're tired, I get it after COVID, we're not going to grow at all. Well, then there's no promotions for that. Where are you going to promote people? There's no new roles. There's nothing that's changing. There's no growth. And people are like, hey, well, what about the promotions? Like, well, I thought you wanted, you know,
consolidation for a while.
Take it easy. Yeah. So again, it's just that reality. I mean, when people were really tired in COVID, it's what do you need? What I really need is to work a quarter of the time and be paid my full salary. And you're like, look, I get it. Like, I understand you're running preschool, you know, over there and you're both in the same thing, but like, we'll be out of business if we do that. So like, how can we help? What can we do? Can we buddy you up? What hours do you need? Like, again, just the honesty of like, the business won't survive with that model. So what can we do? Because I would like that too. but that's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. I like the transparency, and I think that radical transparency, that candor, that openness, I think only good things come from being transparent. But as you say, in a fully baked form rather than a half baked form, and I think that's going to be the foundation of trust. It's going to be the foundation of, you know, building teams that, you know, survive and work together and stay together and ultimately thrive together. So some really useful things there. Hey, Robert, we have touched on a lot of stuff today. I guess one of the things I'd probably like to just finish the conversation with is you've had the opportunity to talk to, you know, countless different businesses. Obviously, you run your own business. You've given TED Talks. You've written lots of books. If you could whisper into the ears of, you know, entrepreneurs, small to medium business owners, and give them, you know, the two or three snippets that you think make the difference, you know, and I know that there's no magic pill and I know there's no magic bullet, but if you were to think about, you know, a couple of salient pieces of information, what would be the gospel according to Robert?
Yeah, I think the first thing would be do less. Like, find the one thing you can be world class at and then everyone comes to you for, and then sort of from there diversify. I see too many people trying to diversify before they're good at anything. I was joking, our industry, you know, if your website has more services than you have people, then you don't really have competencies in those areas. So I think that's one. Two, like, find someone who's can mentor you, who's slightly on the road ahead. I always just really benefited from someone who was doing exactly what I wanted to do or was just 2 to 3 years ahead of me. And I've consulted those people 2 to 3 years behind, and they think I'm like a fortune teller because it's like, it's all been done before. I'm like, this is about what's going to happen next. And this is what's going to happen next. And it does, because I was told the same thing from the person on the road ahead. And then I think the last thing is get yourself with the right people and the right team. Like, it's a grind. Building a business is a grind. It's sexy in the rearview mirror. It's really hard when you're doing it. So if you're not going to like, if you're not going to enjoy the journey, like be focused on the journey, not just the destination. And that journey, a lot of it will be the people that are there with you and that are on that kind of on that grind with you, and that you, it's not always easy, but you like them and you respect them and you want to be on them. Cause when it gets really bad and you don't like the people, it gets so bad so quickly.
Robert, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time to come and join us on the podcast today. I've really enjoyed having a conversation with you, and I really encourage people to go and get a copy of the books, you know, whether it's Elevate or Elevate Your Team. I think both of them are going to be really critical and useful handbooks for people. I really enjoyed the framework around capacity, and thank you for writing it. Thank you for creating it, because I think it's just so instructive for individuals, for organizations across the board. So from all of us here, mate, I'm really grateful to you for taking the time today, your night time, our today, to come and talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.